This is the Takeaway Memorial Day special for 2017. Thanks for listening. Have a great holiday.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. This hour, Memorial Day. Conversations all hour about sacrifices in war zones far away and some of the challenges for veterans here at home. He's a former pilot and Vietnam POW, Senator John McCain, former presidential candidate, and in many ways the soul of the United States Senate, says the U.S. is a country with a conscience. It's a conscience worth fighting for, McCain says. And he calls the U.S. the chief architect and defender of an international order that is based on treasured, shared moral values and concerns, including human rights, even though America has had its own struggles coming to terms with those human rights.
Well, on a Memorial Day, obviously, we think about all the service and sacrifice that for generations Americans have made, usually in defense of somebody else's freedom, but also most of the time for our values and the things that we believe in, including our initial commitment to our belief that all of us are created equal and endowed by certain inalienable rights. And so I think about the fact that the world is a far better and different place thanks to their service and sacrifice. And could I just point out, the 20th century was called the American century for a reason. It's because we really did literally make the world safe for democracy, and that lasted for a long time. It is now under enormous strain, but it was purchased at the sacrifice of enormous amount of American blood and treasure.
And your own personal sacrifice, do you think the value of that holds true in the 21st century? You've spoken about the perilous potential for losing that leadership in the world.
Well, I worry a lot when not just this Secretary of State, but others believe that our only role in the world is to have dollars and cents and profits and loss and only protect those interests that are in America's interest. Well, if you believe in America's interest are a selfish and narrow set of goals, then we are no different from any other nation, and nations rise and fall. And the thing that I think that makes America unique is that we are a beacon. And as Ronald Reagan used to mention all the time, a shining city on a hill.
Americans are more separated from the military community than they've ever been. I think the numbers show just how many civilians there are and how few people in service there are and how little they intersect, their lives intersect. Do you know of such a place where American civilians should really take a look, spend a moment thinking about what these sacrifices represent that might bridge that gap that we all know so well?
Well, we have a number of memorials here in our nation's capital, and of course, my favorite is the Vietnam War Memorial, where 58,000 names are etched in black granite. But I take a bit of an exception to the premise here. There was a time when our brave men and women who were serving in the military in Vietnam were vilified when they returned. And most of them were draftees, by the way, who were drafted and yet went to Vietnam and served and came home. Some of them were spat upon. They had limited job opportunities. They were a reflection of the intense anti-war sentiment was reflected on them. I believe it was one of the more shameful chapters in American history. And I think Americans deeply regret that. And that's why we honor them so much. I don't go to a baseball game without a veteran being honored. So even though only a small percentage of Americans actually serve in uniform, the esteem and appreciation and even love and affection that we bestow on them is something that, frankly, I'm extremely proud of.
Well, you note changes that I would absolutely agree with you on, but the service members from Iraq and Afghanistan hope, I think, that it goes beyond those ceremonial moments, and that a greater intersection between civilian life and military life would give Americans more of a consensus about this mission.
I agree with that, but I don't know of a major corporation in America that doesn't have an active and really strong hire a veteran drive effort on their part. And they, when they hire a large number of veterans, they brag about it and they're proud of it. I'm proud that in my home city of Phoenix, Arizona, we don't have a homeless veteran because we've constructed a facility there to get our homeless veterans off the street. One of the two major factors in veteran suicide is homelessness and joblessness. And I really feel that Americans honor our veterans in the most incredible fashion. And I think, again, part of it is a hangover from the Vietnam era. But I'm proud of the way that we honor our men and women who serve and honor those who have served.
Senator John McCain, thank you so much.
Always great to talk to you. Thanks again.
And happy Memorial Day to you, sir.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
U.S. Senator John McCain, Republican from Arizona and Vietnam War veteran. During President Donald Trump's first months in office, the principle of civilian leadership of the U.S. military has been challenged by the pattern of delegating the management of military operations to the Pentagon, having former generals as advisors and cabinet officers. It's a change in approach from the era of Barack Obama, who insisted on managing military matters in many cases out of the White House. Andrew de Grandpre is senior editor and Pentagon bureau chief for Military Times. Civilian leadership is not threatened, he says, but there is caution that this new autonomy might encourage some impulses within the Pentagon that need to be controlled.
The generals and the admirals are really walking a tightrope, so to speak. The strategies that they're looking at in places like Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, you could even zoom out and say, you know, with Russia and North Korea, these decisions are all being made keeping in mind that, you know, for all intents and purposes, they're working for a new boss, and most certainly their new boss is watching how they do business. And so to some degree, I think they feel as though they're on a bit of a short leash, and they have the onus on them to demonstrate that, you know, they're not going to be reckless when they make certain decisions, and that they are going to meet the president's directive of bringing more force to bear on America's adversaries, but doing so responsibly.
You talked about that Mattis and the folks that are working with him want to project a certain amount of expertise and caution in the use of military force, correct?
That's correct.
So if Trump proposes some, we've got to respond, you know, forcefully to Syria, and the Pentagon says, well, we don't actually want to put boots on the ground in Syria and do anything that escalates anything, but we can just, you know, launch some cruise missiles that will call him off. It seems as though it's a little bit of a patronizing gesture as opposed to something that's broadly military and strategic. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I don't know that I would characterize it that way necessarily. I have to imagine that the conversation went something like this. There was a chemical attack in Syria. Obviously, we know from the tremendous reporting that's being done on the White House that Trump was greatly affected by what he saw on TV. The images of people writhing on the ground, and he wanted a response. It's the Pentagon's responsibility to present the president with options. And I'm sure that as a part of his national security team's discussions throughout that ordeal, they were looking at ways where they could make a bold statement without necessarily drawing the United States into a much deeper set of circumstances inside Syria. Obviously, that battlefield is challenged by a number of factors. The U.S., their principal interest remains ISIS. But at the same time, sure, you've seen that the White House is looking at the human suffering that's happening as a consequence of the civil war. And they're looking to find resolutions there. And I think that the use of those cruise missiles, those Tomahawk missiles to attack that Syrian airfield was meant to be a statement by the president to say, you know, this won't be tolerated, and you really can't predict what I'm going to do if you try to use these weapons again.
So from the perspective of soldiers and people, officers within the U.S. military, given scenarios like that and what you've described, is Trump really a commander-in-chief here, or has something changed?
I think President Trump is learning how to be the commander-in-chief. And I would say that he's certainly enamored with the idea of leading the military. You know, we saw him several weeks back appear on the aircraft carrier Gerald Ford sporting the, you know, the hat and the bomber jacket and making bold promises to the men and women in uniform about how he's going to rebuild the military. My organization, Military Times, conducted some polling of the military pre-election, and Trump was the favored for sure. But it was close, and the troops didn't necessarily like former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. They liked the Libertarian candidate, and at one point during our polling prior to the election, we saw that Trump and the Libertarian, Gary Johnson, were essentially tied, which says to me that going into the start of his presidency, Donald Trump had something to prove to the men and women in the military to gain their confidence. I think he's trying to do that by saying to them, I see that you've been restrained for the last 8 years, and I see that our readiness rates are not up to standard, and I see that you're conducting multiple tours of duty and it's causing strain on your family, and I'm going to do something about that. And I think that he's trying to show the military that he's going to take care of them and also enable them in a way that perhaps they have not been under President Obama. So early in the start of his tenure, it really does remain to be seen how he's going to be successful at that.
Well, it's certainly a morale booster if president is able to do the kinds of things that you're talking about there in terms of readiness and improve the sense of confidence in the military. Through the kinds of investments that he's talked about, and they are sizable. But is there a danger that the framers of the Constitution maybe didn't want the president to be, and Eisenhower, you know, alluded to this, to be dazzled by the military to the extent that his judgment or her judgment might be impaired? What do you think of that?
I think that's a great question to ask. Early on, we're seeing certainly the president is making moves and making statements about the military that would suggest he is very proud to lead them. And at the same time, we're seeing actions on the battlefield that would definitely suggest that he's more than willing to delegate some of the responsibilities I think that his predecessor held very close to the White House to the generals and to the admirals. Ultimately, the president is going to have to decide if those decisions are acting in America's best interest. And I don't know, at least in the near term, that you're going to see a return, say, of 100,000 people, 100,000 U.S. troops to places like Iraq or Afghanistan, simply because I don't think the president wants to be bogged down again in another long conflict that involves tough urban fighting, which he most certainly would encounter should he put more boots on the ground in Syria, in Iraq, in Afghanistan.
Thank you for those thoughts on this Memorial Day. And A pleasant and meaningful Memorial Day to you, Andrew.
Thanks very much.
Andrew de Grandpre is senior editor and Pentagon bureau chief for Military Times. More time and attention has been devoted to the issue of veteran suicide than ever before. Last year, the VA published a study that examined veterans' records from 1979 to 2014 and found that an average of 20 veterans each day die from suicide. 65% of those are 50 or older. Bobby O'Brien is a reporter-producer covering veterans and military affairs for WUSF Public Media in Florida. She's also a correspondent for the American Homefront Project, and today she brings us a story from Tampa, where a group of family and friends recently gathered to memorialize their lost loved ones and combat the stigma of veteran suicide.
American Legion Post 5 sits just off one of Tampa's busiest roads, Dale Mabry Highway, named for an Army captain who died in an airship accident after World War I. It's common to name streets, buildings, and bridges after military members who have died while serving their country. But as Kathy Sprigg spoke to the gathering at Post 5, she said such traditions only remind her of honors not given to her son, Army Specialist Robert Joseph Allen died by suicide in 2012 after serving in Iraq 2 years earlier.
When my Rob's body came home and at the funeral, through no fault of theirs, there were no law enforcement or Patriot riders to escort him through streets with flag-waving citizens. There was no flag lowered at half-staff in his honor.
But in Sprigg's mind, her son's death is directly related to his service with the infantry in Iraq. She said he returned with symptoms of post-traumatic stress, paranoia, sleeplessness, and nightmares that he was burning alive inside his Stryker armored vehicle.
When my Robbie returned to Fort Lewis, Washington, after his deployment from Iraq, I rejoiced and thanked God that he came home safe and sound. Little did I know he didn't. His wounds were invisible.
There's been a lot of attention in recent years on reducing military and veteran suicide. Congress and the Department of Veterans Affairs have added mental health counselors, created peer support groups, and now require all service members to have annual mental health assessments. Still, for surviving family members, there's often a sense of stigma and isolation. That's why Post 5 held its special ceremony a week before Memorial Day. The idea came from Post member Tony Williams, who heads up the Legion's District 15 Suicide Prevention Committee.
Focus is on the recognition of a service member who gave his life, even if it was not on the battlefield, but he gave his life. And we don't want to minimize that because that's part of the stigma. We don't want to minimize that. We want to still rejoice the fact that he's still a hero.
And sometimes it's more comfortable for families of suicide victims to do that separately, away from the traditional Memorial Day ceremonies. Kim Ruwako's husband, a Marine helicopter pilot, died by suicide in 2005. She now is with TAPS, a group that works with grieving military families.
For suicide loss survivors, sometimes it is helpful to be around others who have had a similar loss to decrease the shame and help be with peers who really understand their journey. So for suicide loss survivors, it's very comforting to be with peers and sometimes to do memorials separately from other kinds of losses in the military.
Those separate memorial services like the one at Post 5 are still relatively rare. But for survivors like Kathy Sprigg, they can be transformational. This was only the third time she talked publicly about her son, who was 27 when he died and left two young children.
Talking about him as a person, makes him not just a number, not just a percentage, but an actual human being that lived and laughed and loved. That's healing.
Healing, not just for her, but for many of the 50 or so people in the Legion Hall during the ceremony. Towards the end, another mother came to the microphone, Toni Gross, who lost her son in combat in Afghanistan. She called Sprigg back up to the front.
When Kathy was saying her son's name and said that there was no Patriot Guard riders there, I wanted to get up and clap. So if Kathy would say her son's name, and we'll give him the honor that he deserved for serving this United States of America. Army Specialist Robert Joseph Allen.
Sprigg said that while the pain of her loss will never go away, this was one of the few times since her son died that he was remembered not as a suicide victim, but as a soldier who served his country. I'm Bobby O'Brien in Tampa.
Bobby O'Brien's story comes to us from the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. The Homefront Project has been talking to veterans about who they remember and how they commemorate Memorial Day, and they bring us this postcard.
My name is Mark Lebesky. I'm a Master Chief in the Navy. I'm also a Navy SEAL. I have been in the military over 31 years now, and I am retiring this summer. I came in the service in 85. I was on an operation in 1989, Operation Just Cause in Panama, where I lost two very good friends of mine. Four ended up dying that day, Being here at the headquarters here, I'm able to go to the memorial that we have out there and, you know, get to visit my friends there. Their names are inscribed on the plaque, but I usually say hello to them. We're men dedicated to our country that try to get the job done and really are proud of what they're doing. And it's just a good time to reflect on how great our country actually is and it's worth preserving.
I'm James Joseph Bartholomew Harkins IV. I served in the United States Air Force between 1954 and 1974. We were the generation that was born just before the Second World War. And patriotism was in our blood. And the Korean War came along and a lot of us volunteered. I was in the National Guard. And then after that, I couldn't wait to get in the Air Force because that's part of our DNA. I remember all of my friends that are on the wall for Vietnam. One of my very dearest friends, Art Bader, got lost in Cambodia, and they finally found him some years ago.
Veteran Voices from the American Homefront Project. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. The horse is among the proudest symbols of military prowess and tactics. And when the modern military dispensed with horses to embrace a modern mechanized army with helicopter gunships, medical rescue aircraft, and choppers, it still called them the cavalry.
At ease, gentlemen. Welcome to the new cavalry. We will ride into battle, and this will be our horse.
As the voice of Mel Gibson as Lieutenant General Hal Moore in the 2002 film We Were Soldiers, General Moore took the helicopter into the Battle of Yadrang in Vietnam, and that changed warfare for good. In fact, the signature sound of American troops in battle is the arrival of the helicopter, as you can hear in these movie excerpts from Apocalypse Now to Black Hawk Down to Lone Survivor.
Outstanding, good team, outstanding. Get your case of beer for that.
We're touching down and charging.
Ship support. Can you put us on the ground without the Apaches?
We'll do what we have to do to get you on the ground with your men.
Thank you.
The helicopter was truly the iconic symbol of the Vietnam War. Actually, the Marines considered it, but the Army embraced it, and Vietnam was a perfect place to employ this helicopter in terrain that went all the way from muddy rice paddies to mountains that had very few roads, very limited abilities to maneuver a modern army.
That's retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Bob Hesselbein. He piloted helicopters in Vietnam at the age of 19.
The air cavalry proved itself as well by its ability to move great distances and engage with the enemy and, importantly, support those troops on the ground where no roads were available, no train tracks were there. They literally brought them and then brought them out of hell.
There's a special language of the chopper commander, including the LZ, the often dangerous landing zones, and other words.
The terms that come to my mind are things such as rules of engagement, which forced us to be very careful when we employed our firepower. Things such as popping smoke, identifying the smoke because the enemy would throw out a smoke as well, and you had to make sure that you were, if you're a Huey pilot, landing to the proper place so you didn't fly into an ambush. One term that comes to my mind, a wonderful war correspondent who was there in the first cab in 1965, Joe Galloway, he describes the helicopter pilots and crew members as God's own lunatics. And that's because they were brave enough and crazy enough and fearless enough to do what they had to do operating those flimsy helicopters to support the troops on the ground.
Bob looks back on his time flying helicopters and his fellow pilots and crew with a tremendous amount of respect and admiration. People who often watched helpless at close range as their fellow soldiers were killed in conditions where no one could survive.
They went in knowing the risk, but yet they went in anyways, and some of them died. Some of them, such as a person named Wade Ellen, who's missing in action still, he'll never be recovered. Wade died, but he knew the risk, and he went in anyways. That's what I see, and that's why it's important to remember these people and the sacrifice with an appropriate monument.
This history, these helicopter tactics, and the changes they made to warfare will get that monument at an unprecedented site at Arlington National Cemetery set to open in 2018, a process years in the making. More on that with Senator Tammy Baldwin coming up next.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering tech products, solutions, and services for business like PC setup and repair, data recovery, and virus protection. More at staples.com/tech services. Staples, it's pro time.
It is the passion and determination of Bob Hesselbein, U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin from Wisconsin, and two of her congressional colleagues that are largely responsible for the decision to install a monument at Arlington National Cemetery, honoring the nearly 5,000 helicopter pilots and crew members who lost their lives in service in Vietnam. Senator Baldwin took time out to speak with us about the Vietnam Helicopter Crew Monument Act she co-authored and just how much is on her mind this Memorial Day.
The Vietnam Helicopter Pilots Association has been trying for a long time to move this forward. Funding was resolved because they've raised private dollars for the memorial. Issues of size and scale were worked out, but apparently resistance was still encountered by this association. And so I was really pleased to be able to work with Bob Hesselbein and other leaders from the association and introduce bipartisan legislation to help leverage the movement forward. And we are so pleased to now have approval.
And I gather this will give you some personal comfort and satisfaction on this 2017 Memorial Day.
Absolutely. You know, the stories need to be told, and there are so many ways to tell stories. There's the Oral History Project, which I so support, and we can all participate in and learn about. But there's also the places that we come to remember, to honor. And Arlington National Cemetery is chief among them. And this will bring me and so many of the folks who are helicopter pilots or crew members who served in Vietnam or loved a helicopter pilot or crew member who served in Vietnam. It'll bring them a lot of pleasure to know that this memorial is on its way to being established.
Senator McCain has suggested in a message for Memorial Day that he's concerned that it's possible that the President of the United States and his administration takes a cavalier attitude towards some of the values that indeed were fought for, freedom, American security, and the kinds of issues that have come up. Do you expect to hear anything like that from your constituents, or have you already heard it?
I certainly hear strongly worded concerns about what's going on in Washington. And I can point to one, and I'm not sure what Senator McCain, my colleague, was referring to specifically or what set of events. But by way of example, the visit to CIA headquarters in the first days of this administration and standing in front of that wall of stars and not saying one word about it. It's difficult to imagine. We do celebrate as Americans, and frankly, it's one of the things that unites us as Americans, our freedom, our democracy. I think a lot of my constituents fear, and for rational reasons, that our democracy is under attack from without and in some ways from within. It's important to remember those principles on not only Memorial Day, but every day.
Lots to think about this Memorial Day, and we're gratified to be able to speak with you about it, Senator Tammy Baldwin. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to join you.
Senator Tammy Baldwin is a Democrat from the state of Wisconsin and author of the bipartisan Vietnam Helicopter Crew Member Monument Act. That monument is scheduled to open next year. Since we've been talking about Arlington National Cemetery for a bit, let's stroll together now through our nation's most honored military burial ground.
If you strolled through Arlington and you came in from our northern edge, you would pass by the oldest grave in the cemetery, which is Private Crispin, who was a casualty of the Civil War.
Walk a little further and you'll find yourself on the Custis Walk. The Custis family's plantation was the origin of the acreage that is now Arlington.
And that walk will take you up eventually to pass by JFK, our president, who really put Arlington on the map in terms of the public view of Arlington. And so what a spectrum to have there, all the way from presidents to privates, in terms of who Arlington is there to remember and honor.
Spread across 624 acres, Arlington National Cemetery is the final resting place for presidents William Howard Taft, John F. Kennedy, Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, countless military heroes like George C. Marshall and Major Walter Reed, as well as Anita Newcomb, the first female surgeon in the U.S. Army. And of course, the most visited site at Arlington, the Tomb of the Unknowns. With more than 400,000 graves already, the cemetery faces some very real space challenges in the years ahead. Catherine Kelly is the superintendent of Arlington National Cemetery. She's been giving us that tour, and she says it's a very special place, full of stories of great loss and great respect for long history of sacrifice.
It is an absolute reward and privilege to be part of it. From the outside, running past the wall, it may look calm and tranquil, but we provide, on average, 30 services a day for families, and it is absolutely a tremendous demand to come to Arlington and to earn that place at Arlington. No grave can be bought. It is an earned opportunity, and we take that very seriously in caring for those that are interred there.
With the tragic death of my cousin, who was in the Marine Band and was, you know, in uniform service, he got a funeral and a burial at Arlington, and we were brought into a chapel the back way, as families typically are, I've learned since. And an amazing minister came to us, and in his face was this idea of something amazing is about to happen. And he said, we're going to have a very fine, fine funeral today. And I didn't quite understand what he meant until we went out and they have the reserved spot for the families there right in the front. And we sat down and this funeral, this chapel was packed, packed with people who'd known my cousin. And I mean, it was one of the most overwhelming experiences of my life. And when I asked the clergyman about this, he said, we have chapels for every size. There are people for whom no family come. There are funerals like this that are a giant celebration. And I was so moved by that. I thought, this is so much more than a cemetery.
Thank you for saying it that way. I'm moved listening to the story, and we work very hard every day to make sure that families have the experience that they need to have at that time in their life. For many, it is a joyous time. We bury veterans who've lived full and wonderful lives, and for many, it is a sad time and a grieving time. And we work very hard at the cemetery to ensure that whomever is there for whatever purpose, at whatever stage of their life, they are having the experience that is Arlington National Cemetery. We are a national shrine. We are an iconic symbol of the nation. And we want to remain that way, and we want to remain able to deliver that experience to those who have earned it.
Well, my cousin Ricky Lieben, you know, won no medals, you know, it underscored this idea of he was yet still eligible, and his service was recognized like anyone else's. And he chose to be cremated, and he was put in a wall, which reminded me of the space considerations. And you could see some sign of that at Arlington, that space is at a premium right now. And You said you can't buy a gravesite at Arlington, but still the demand it would seem to exceed the supply.
It absolutely does, John. It's the biggest challenge facing myself and all of the staff at Arlington and the Army, quite frankly, who's entrusted with the care of Arlington. The demand for space at Arlington absolutely outweighs the remaining available space. We just submitted a report to Congress that outlines we will be out of first internment space in the near term, 2040, meaning in the next 25 years, we will be out of space if nothing else changes. And we are absolutely at a point where we need a national dialogue about how to continue to evolve Arlington and to be available for veterans well into the future.
Are the challenges surmountable for space, and are there changes that are likely to be made in the near term, or is this something that we have to look forward to maybe decades down the line?
I would tell you that there is great support to allow Arlington to continue to do the tremendous work that it does each and every day. We have great support to try to expand the cemetery in a physical expansion. And we really need to continue discussion about our southern border and how to actually bring forward additional acreage to the cemetery. The harder dialogue is about eligibility. And that is something that I think is going to take a significant amount of time and really needs to be that national discussion because that is the emotional issue for people who is eligible. And of course, the physical expansion of the cemetery borders is not new. It's happened in the past. But there are complexities to it, John, that of course you understand, and I'm sure your listeners do as well, that you really need to take time to do a deliberate process in order to bring that to fruition.
Well, Catherine Kelly, Superintendent of Arlington National Cemetery, thank you so much, and have a meaningful Memorial Day this year.
Thank you so much, John. You know, every day is Memorial Day for us at Arlington, but the actual event is just a tremendous and special place for us to be, and we look forward to it and welcome anybody to come and visit us.
Do not call us fallen. Do not call us fallen. We did not falter when you called. We volunteered with all our hearts, knowing the cost involved. We entered a new world without fears of trials ahead. We were tested, we were tempted, but we ventured on instead.
Major Tenaya Humphrey comes from a military family, and she wrote this poem about one of her jobs in the military that took her into no combat zone and never put her into harm's way.
The details of our journey we may have taken to our graves, but know that they were completed on that last moment of that last day. Our death was not our testing. We aced that before our time. It is your true test instead, as you were left behind. This marks neither the end for us nor the end for you. It is but a part of our greater story, that which will continue. Do not focus on our death, but on how we lived our lives. When greater than us called, we made a conscious sacrifice.
Major Tenaya Humphrey has performed one of the most important and solemn duties of the U.S. military, returning the bodies or remains of service members who have died. There have been thousands of takeoffs and landings from battlefields far away to Dover Air Force Base in Delaware, where caskets are given military honors and then flown onto their families. These are especially emotional missions for the air crews who perform them. The C-17 is the aircraft that flies the honored soldiers home. Major Tenaya Humphrey is a C-17 pilot, and these flights are unique, she says, like nothing else in the air, civilian or military.
Really, my job was, as part of the C-17 crew, was to bring those fallen service members home to Dover Air Force Base, where they would be prepared, essentially, for their final resting place, and then we had a secondary duty, and that was to fly them to their final resting place.
The flight to Dover has this meaning that will never change. I mean, who knew anything about Dover until this happened, right?
Dover's a very special place. There are a lot of missions that the C-17 and C-5 fly out of Dover, but this is a very sacred mission. It's a mission that we do for our fallen brothers and sisters in arms, and it's something that the crews take very personally. It's an emotional process, but it's something that everybody involved, the crews down to the Air Force Mortuary Affairs, to everyone wants to do this job as perfect as possible for the families mostly.
And how does it look? What does it mean? What happens first and what happens last?
Well, the flight is a quiet flight across an ocean, and you land at Dover, and then a dignified transfer occurs where you have, if it's a fallen Marine, say, then you have a carry team that are comprised of Marines, and think about white gloves and a very slow process of taking this flag-draped casket or carry box into a transport vehicle, and oftentimes the families are there and the crew is at attention, and everything is completely quiet on the ramp. No aircraft are moving, no engines are on. It's quiet, it's sacred. Everybody knows the importance, the significance of what's going on.
And in your case, this whole ritual relates to your own family.
That's correct. When I was a girl, we lost our father in a B-1 accident, and so his remains were taken to Dover and then to his final resting place in Colorado Springs. And so certainly when I see those family members on the other side, seeing their loved one for the first time in that way, my heart breaks for their family, because I know that grieving process, and I know it takes a long time. And I honor the sacrifice that the families make, because it's a long, enduring sacrifice. It takes a lifetime.
What do you remember of that 1992 accident and the way in which the military honored your father in this, again, simple, quiet ritual of repatriation?
The fallen service members are given an escort. So that was the case with my father as well. And his escort actually wrote our family a letter about the whole process, because it wasn't open to the media at that time. So we were not involved in that process. We were there in Colorado Springs at the Air Force Academy. And I remember this, you know, beautiful ceremony. And since he was flying the B-1, he had his friends did the flyover. Sorry, it gets me choked up a little bit.
Yeah, sure.
But it was a B-1 flew over so low that the whole sky disappeared. It was such a beautiful tribute to a sacrifice, and I'll always be thankful for those crew members who did that amazing flyover.
Memorial Day is, you know, a day of parties and all kinds of things, and you know, we don't want to begrudge Americans their sense of leisure and time off and all of that. There's plenty of time to remember for a moment, perhaps, what the holiday means. But if someone was taken out of their leisure 3-day weekend and magically transported to just stand alone on that tarmac at Dover, what would that feel like?
My mind always goes back to a comparison. If we're talking about a generation like the World War I and World War II generations, where you had so many people, at least 10% of the population, that were serving, everybody knew someone who was serving. When someone passed, it was a collective grieving process. Society understood this experience, this collective experience. And today, we think about there's only about 0.5% of the U.S. population that serves in the military. And of that, since 2001, a very small percentage have lost their lives. But to the family members, one person is everything. And so I think it does give us pause. If you thought about being on that tarmac at Dover and looking at that flag-draped case, understanding for a moment that there are people willing to pay the ultimate sacrifice, but also sacrifice on a daily basis for others. I think that's important. That's something that we can all agree upon, that sacrificing for others is significant and worthy of a pause.
Major Tanaya Humphrey is a C-17 and T-1 pilot and instructor at Air Command and Staff College, and also flies the repatriation flights from wherever American soldiers are in harm's way to Dover Air Force Base and then home. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Earlier this hour, Senator and decorated war veteran John McCain and I had a friendly disagreement. I noted that there is a wide division between the culture of the men and women in service and civilian culture in America. And he pushed back and said no. He was telling me that what matters is that we recognize the same values and struggles, no matter who we are. And it came to me just what he meant as I heard about the tragedy on a commuter train in Portland, Oregon on Friday. The man with a knife filled with hate hurling anti-Muslim insults at two women of color, one wearing a Muslim hijab. A number of people on the train moved to protect the women. The man began stabbing people. Three of the men who placed themselves between the attacker and these women paid dearly. One, Micah Fletcher, hospitalized with a serious neck injury. Ricky John Best, military veteran, father of four, died at the scene. 23-year-old and recent college grad Taliesin Namkhimesh died at the hospital. We most often think of the history book wars on this Memorial Day. But last Friday, a veteran and a civilian fighting side by side in the war against hate lost their lives on the front lines in a conflict we can never forget. That's all from us. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
PRI, Public Radio International.